Hello and welcome to Androids and Assets. I'm Marshall.
And I'm Steven.
This is the show where we talk about economics and politics in science fiction and fantasy. So that's breaking down things like the power and social structures in the stories that we love and the stories that you love.
Yeah. Like, where does food come from in X? You know, like, how do things get made? How do things get done? Who's doing it?
That's
those are the questions we like to ask. And God damn it, it's hard sometimes. Speaking of places where there's really fucked up relationships between how people who do things and how things get done, today we're talking about Star Wars.
Episode 9, The Rise of Skywalker.
And to help us with that, we have a very special guest, a dear friend of the show who's receiving their medal for second appearance. I think maybe our second repeat guest.
Yeah. Yeah, ever. Yeah, I think it might be the only second repeat guest. So congratulations, you're number two.
Yes.
Yeah, the very insightful and erudite and truly kind Justin. Welcome to the show, Justin.
Wow, thank you. That's high praise.
Justin is...
I like to be described as kind, and I also like to imagine myself as Chewbacca finally getting that dumbass medal.
that infuriated me. And maybe it shouldn't have. But anyway, Justin, you are a humanities researcher, and we won't go into the details of it, but you do some kind of research in the humanities.
The humanities, particularly film and other visual media.
Yeah, I'm doing my I'm a PhD candidate in film studies at the University of Toronto.
So we've established that you have film critique credibility. Can we establish your bona fides for loving Star Wars? When did you first see Star Wars?
I don't remember the year. I was under 10. I was 8 or 9, and my best friend was obsessed, which, you know, everybody's obsessed with Star Wars, but he was, I think he had a much older brother who had been there on the ground floor, and so had like all the original Kenner toys. And he would kind of bully me with Star Wars. Most of my friends until I got into high school were just bullies. So I'm going to talk about that now. I'm just kidding. He just wouldn't shut up about Star Wars, and so I was desperate to see it for months and months. One Friday evening, I begged my mother to go to the video store and rent it on VHS. And because the video store was just about to close, she insisted I stay in the car while she ran in and grab it. And when she came back, she had Return of the Jedi, which I knew was the last film at that point. She claimed that was the only one they had, when actually I think she probably just grabbed whichever one was there. And then we got home, she said it was too late to watch it, and so I just laid in bed all night long, like it was Christmas Eve or something, so excited. And then got up at 5 a.m. and watched it, like sitting very close to the TV with the sound low, and was just immediately taken, and therefore still love Return of the Jedi. And it's not like anything was ruined for me anyway, because, you know, I'd spent months listening to this guy basically recounting the narratives of the film, so it wasn't like, what, he's his dad?
I spent half a decade not having seen episode 4,
but having seen but five
having
and six.
Seen
yes
5 and 6
yeah
wow and so half, how did 4 strike you then? Because they're
very confusing.
5 and 6 are of a piece, but 4 is a very different film.
I just wanted it fueled in me a desire to know more about it, and it gave me a lot of room to interpose my own sense of. Because my dad kind of gave me like an oral, like a briefing on what had happened in A New Hope. So I kind of had this oral history that augmented the movie. So I kind of got to inject my own conception about Star Wars. I think that's something that it continues with me to this day, I guess, that, you know, I like to interject and do my own thing with stuff. So,
I mean, you have to wonder how many people in our generation went into seeing those movies with kind of oral history from people, older people we knew, who were themselves obsessed, and just kind of gave us their version of it. I mean, it's interesting. I still kind of have an obsession with 4, precisely because it is it's the perfect text in that it has so many openings for the audience's own imaginative possibility that are so kind of well defined within it that you can still feel them, even though you know you can look up on Wikipedia the name of the guy way in the background, and you know the general arc. And so just kind of imagining doing the Alan Dean Foster thing, what this could have been, you know, like Luke and Leia, real fantasy. No, I'm just kidding.
Well, yeah, I think there's a lot of stuff, and reference to events. Like they talk about the running into the bounty hunter, you know, and all these things. And there's when they're just running around and there's those long takes on Hoth. That was really for me. I remember being a child, they talk about at one point, Leia's mad at Han, and Han's talking about you didn't act that way in the South Passage, referring to a conversation that had earlier in the movie. But I was like, ooh, what's the South Passage? Is that they talk about that in the first movie? So for a long time, I had this what's the tale of what happened with Han and Leia in the South Passage?
I see. Okay, yeah. So you had questions from the subsequent movies that you thought would be answered by four,
and I was disappointed. Yeah.
Well, I mean, I meant the questions that are in four. You know, when the whole first Obi-Wan sequence. You know, and he's like, "I fought with your father in the Clone Wars." You're like, "What is that?"
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
It's a cartoon. Oh, just kidding. I love the Clone Wars far better than the sequel films. That's my hot take.
Well, anyway, okay, that's good. Change my opinion meme here.
The Rise of Skywalker. You've seen it? How quickly after it came out in theaters did you get to see it?
Well, I thought that I thought it would be a while because of for personal reasons, but it worked out that it was the second week, and then I've seen it twice since then.
So had you already been sort of hardened to the film from reactions before you went and saw it?
No, I mean, no, I don't. I think that film criticism as an industry is just a bunch of horseshit. With few exceptions. And so I'd certainly read some criticism, but that never affects my interpretation of the film. And also, it's that thing where if you read criticism of a Star Wars movie and find out that people didn't like it, then it's just like every other Star Wars movie.
Oh, so it's like the other ones. Great. No one likes this movie.
Good.
Yeah. And I mean, generally, you know this about me. I'm a huge prequels nut. I defend those films every single day. And so I'm probably actually more inclined to be excited for something if I hear that everybody hates it. because they're probably wrong, but they weren't wrong in this case.
Fair. I mean, so Star Wars being just what it is and the role it has played in my life, as soon as my partner and I were in the theater, it was just like an emotional moment of my heart is pounding and I'm just I'm so excited to see this movie.
Absolutely.
So we were there the second day it was open, and it's just like, this is going to be so good.
Yeah.
So I was a bit disappointed. Well,
this is what I want to say is that I think that a lot of credit has to go to the production designers, costume designers, John Williams, everyone who works on the music, the sound designers, the creature visual effects, all of that. All of those people deserve a lot of credit because what makes Star Wars work is a certain patina that's really difficult to nail down, and they nailed it down in all three of these movies.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. They all feel very Star Wars.
It's the texture.
And also, all of those people. If I'm sure not everyone, but a lot of those people, if I'm not mistaken, are longtime employees of Lucasfilm long before the acquisition, and so they've been working on Star Wars forever. And so when you go to the movie, for me, it was like when it was over, I had no criticisms while I was watching it because it's just like I'm in Star Wars. You know, you can't possibly feel any negativity.
Yeah.
For me anyway. And then you come down from the high and things start seeming, you know, things start coming into your mind and then the criticisms start. But I think that all of those films will have that essential quality of a Star Wars film. Should have, which is, can I watch it every day over and over and over again.
And the answer is yes.
The answer is yes. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's just on the level of texture.
Just on the, yeah, purely on the level of texture. And all of that credit goes to everybody but the producers, writers, and directors of the film. But I mean, of course, this is just a larger problem that that somehow we still, because of Hollywood, we still think that the most collaborative medium of all time is a singular medium, meaning that it is the entire expression of one individual's voice, which is just ludicrous.
Yeah, yeah. After I got out of the theater, Stephen had texted to ask how was the movie, and I think I said that it was like a series of weird vignettes that were almost like maybe not disconnected, but like overall it was a bunch of steaming garbage, but I loved every moment of it.
Right. Yeah.
Like I loved being in there. I loved seeing these things. But when I thought about it, I was like, oh, so many of these things are so bad for so many reasons, but I loved it.
It's like sitting at home in your underwear in the dark, like eating KFC right out of the bucket.
Right. Like when you think about it later, you're like, how much of that was actually good?
This is...
No, I mean, it's interesting you said that about vignettes of trash. Because this is his issue, is that, I mean, I don't think he puts any thought into it. And I shouldn't make an argument for authorial intent after just saying that it was horseshit. But I do think that J.J. Abrams, whether he thinks about it or not, is kind of the ultimate post-classical filmmaker, and he doesn't know how to do anything else, even though whenever he's speaking, narrative development seems to be his jam, which it isn't at all. And so somehow or other along the way, someone convinced him that the film serial lineage of Star Wars, Flash Gordon and all that, is somehow what is essential to Star Wars, formally and narratively, which is absolutely not true. It's only true in the sense that you have, you know, laser swords and tight fitting space clothes and ray guns. But the films, the prequels and the original three are not structured like a film serial, where a film serial always ends on a cliffhanger, and they live in an eternal present, so that the next episode does away with everything that has happened previously. And so it's literally like, I've explained this to my students as it's just it's a car stuck in a snowdrift and the wheel just keeps spinning and spinning and spinning and spinning. And it doesn't, there is no forward motion at all. So like in a film serial, you'll have a villain who is trying to obtain something. It's a MacGuffin. And then in each episode, there's a new MacGuffin and there's a new weapon that they use, but everything plays out the same. And then in the last episode, they catch the bad guy or he dies or whatever. Someone thought that's what Star Wars is, and it's not at all. Star Wars has a very complex narrative development, and never ends on a cliffhanger. That always ends with, of course, questions for future installments, but it always ends with a very tidy narrative summation and the classical narrative structure. And it has, they all end with a flipping tableau. J.J. Abrams puts in right from the get-go, it was obvious that he didn't understand, because it ended with a cliffhanger, the first one, Force Awakens, which is just, that's not right. So by the time you get to this one, my partner made a comment about this, about how, and this speaks to what you were saying, Stephen, about all the questions that like are sparked in your young mind by The Empire Strikes Back. There's no time between any of these three films.
Mm-mm.
In Empire Strikes Back, it's supposed to be like 3 years or something.
Mm-hmm.
And so like a world of things has happened. They, of course, economically, they were savvy to fill that in with toys and games, whatever, comic books. But for just the viewer who's not involved in that, a whole world has had an effect on this character, and you see character development. Whereas I think all three of these films are, certainly the first two are literally back to back. And has there been any, there hasn't been a significant amount of time between Last Jedi and Rise of Skywalker, has there?
More time.
It didn't seem like it.
At least months.
Yeah.
At least months.
Long enough for the Palpatine broadcast to go out.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and like, I mean, obviously, yeah, because Kylo Ren's been on his scouring of the universe. Leia has been training Rey. You know, like things have happened in that world. But I would say it's on the scale to months, not years.
Yeah. So I don't remember why I said that, but yeah. It literally is. And also, so the structure of film serials, that even comes down to the fact that the film goes out of its way numerous times to try to erase The Last Jedi.
Yeah, well, exactly. That's what I was going to say. It's like, and then partly that gap is put in there in a way to reverse the deviance, to atone for the deviance of The Last Jedi.
Yeah. Atone for the deviance. That's a fantastic way of putting it.
But yeah, well, because I think, and for me, that was I think the thing that made this movie. That's what took it from being to being hurtful or feeling mean. You know, I'm like, oh, there's something. This movie has a mean edge. Like it has a there is a meanness and an embitterment in this. I feel like I felt that in the fandom and in the communities. Rippling out from that, and it's unfortunate to see like the dark side of this. And you know, even and like in these things that like things that feel, if you've been in, you know, being in Star Wars a long time, things that feel like you acknowledge they're funny, like with Chewbacca getting the medal. You acknowledge that it's funny and it is humorous and it's a deep cut, but it also feels extremely disingenuous.
Very disingenuous. And it's not as deep a cut as I think they think it is.
Yeah.
And it's, but I don't know if you noticed this, but because it took me three times, but it's particularly egregious because Leia uses that medal to connect with Ben.
Oh, does she?
She's holding it and like meditating in that sequence. I'm like, what the hell does the medal have to do? But anyways, we don't need to get into the ins and out of that. But what I will say is that I agree that it's particularly egregious because it feels like they were trying to right perceived wrongs of The Last Jedi, which I will say I liked when it came out. After a while, it was the whole movie for me was just the space cow milk scene, because that's so my all time favorite moment in all of Star Wars. I will tell anyone how much I love it.
Yeah.
And after this movie, and I was kind of just shocked with the way that the Rise of Skywalker, in some instances, goes way out of its way, like the rebuilding of the helmet and the whole scene with Luke. I thought I got to revisit The Last Jedi, and I am now of the opinion that The Last Jedi is not only deviant in a lot of really interesting ways. It's actually a legitimately great film, in a way that Star Wars films never are. But the truly hateful thing about this is that the idea that they were correcting universally accepted wrongs with The Last Jedi is wrong. It made more money. Than the Rise of Skywalker already. It was critically a critical darling.
Yeah.
The people who didn't like it were racist trolls online. A very vocal minority who bullied Kelly Marie Tran off of Twitter. And then you come out with this movie in which you have done away with Rose. That's just like it was truly it's just disgusting in a way that I don't usually, you know, corporate politics and film has no bearing on my enjoyment as a viewer. But you couldn't help but feel that watching it.
They made it a thing. They made it a thing in the movie, but consciously. Yeah.
It was very, very disappointing to sort of say like, oh, well, like they gave into those bullies and wrote her out of the movie. And I was talking to somebody else later, and they're like, well, like, I have nothing wrong with Kelly Marie Tran. I didn't like the character of Rose. Okay. And I said, well, what about the character didn't you like? Well, it just, like, it wasn't good.
That's very thoughtful.
Well, again, having rewatched it, I liked her when I saw it the first time, but having rewatched it recently, I actually think all the stuff with her and Finn is the highlight of the film.
Yeah.
And I thought she was a really great example of what makes a rebellion successful.
Yes, and all the stuff with her sister, the way that they established that emotional arc.
Yeah.
I saw a meme recently that was like, it was the scene of Luke throwing the lightsaber over his shoulder. And it, on the one, it was like J.J. Abrams, and it's J.J. Abrams throwing Rose over his shoulder. And then it was like Rian Johnson, and he's throwing Captain Phasma over his shoulder. I'm like, first off, that's not fair because Phasma has a big fight scene in The Last Jedi. And she's just a one-dimensional cardboard cutout, silver stormtrooper typical of J.J. Abrams. He's not, when they introduce Rose, before you even see her, you have this whole harrowing scene with her sister, and with this amazing set piece with the bombers. And then when you finally arrive on Rose and she's mourning over her, you know, the friendship bracelets or whatever,
the talisman,
you're already emotionally invested. She hasn't said a word. That's just, that's great character development.
Yeah. And like, just as a person, like she's putting a lot at risk without having any sort of like power at all. Right. Like she stands up to Finn, who he's recognized as being, I don't know, like a hero at this point for whatever reason. And she's just like, no, my job is to stop you. And like, I don't care. Like this is what we do.
And then at the end, he's going to sacrifice. He's going to martyr himself to stop the miniaturized Death Star tech. And she crashes her plane into him and says something like we're going to win by saving what we love, not destroying what we hate, or something.
Yeah.
It's like that's a really powerful and a far clearer articulation of what the rebellion is supposed to be in these films than certainly happens in this film.
Well, no, absolutely. Yeah.
Well, this kind of brings it to my principal grievance with Rise of Skywalker, which is the way and what again for me like reinforces how amazing The Last Jedi was comparatively, like how much I miss it. Yeah, it just in terms of the way it talks about the politics of insurgency.
Yeah.
Because one of the things that they do is they actually, one of the things that starts to happen in The Last Jedi is actually an exploration of how when you have an armed struggle, you have a political struggle, you have an armed struggle, and that means you have a constituency. And that ultimately the failure of the rebellion has been its decision to be a conventional army without a larger political program that just fights things. And that is ultimately caused it to fail. And the only way it will survive is by reconnecting with its constituency, revitalizing its political program, and, you know, and actually serving the agenda of the, you know, of the people in the universe, and that includes particularly the oppressed,
right?
That's what gives it hope, is the fact that it has been laid low, and it is now connecting with its authentic, you know, with its authentic base, and it's moving forward in addressing their particular concerns.
Broom boy,
yeah, exactly. And you know, and people are like, you know, and so I think this is one thing to talk about, like, you know, like this is like, that's great, like how, like, you know, I think we talked about this when we talked about The Last Jedi, how crazy that is. Like, it's crazy, like, you're in this kid and you're like, and that kid's gonna be holding a hand grenade,
a mainstream Hollywood film at all.
Yeah, like in this concept of, like, yeah, this kid's gonna be throwing a Molotov cocktail in a decade, you know, like, yeah. That's crazy to think
and it's
about.
It's interesting that they seem to understand that they had to keep that thread. And so what they do is they just don't develop it at all, and then just expect us to believe that there has been grassroots mobilization of every, you know, oppressed person in the galaxy.
Yeah, it's just
they all found their way to the secret Sith planet.
Yeah, without any leadership or instruction. Yes, and when you, especially, you've made a big point how no one can get there without the magical MacGuffin.
No. Well, they leave
a path.
They made a path.
Okay.
They had the leadership of sexy Lando Calrissian and Chewbacca, right?
Yes. Okay.
Which someone pointed out that Lando is wearing the exact same costume that Donald Glover is wearing in Solo.
Oh, that's interesting.
People are like, can you imagine that if you're like, ha ha, I got my clothes out from 40 years ago. I will say that I like the potential of, since we're talking about this, I like the potential at the very end of the film when the other new character, the other stormtrooper, on another moon of Endor, asks him where he's from, and he says, an old system, where are you from? She doesn't know, and he's like, let's find out. I'm like, what, are you gonna make that movie? That sounds great.
Yeah, I would watch that movie.
So sorry, just a few things I want to finish up here, just in terms of like rebellion and constituents. And this Deus Ex Machina of the people, you know, which is, I think, the most abused concept, and it's a very popular one. It does so much work in our discourse about politics and society. Well, who is your constituency for your rebellion? Marshall's pointing out, like ship owners, you know,
yeah.
property people already have private military vehicles.
Yeah, like Broom Boy that they introduced in the previous movie doesn't even actually get a chance to be part of the rebellion because he probably doesn't have any way to get to the...
Well, he's clearly an indentured... Well, he actually, he may be, I was going to say indentured servant, he may be a slave.
Yeah. Like, what are the odds that he also has a ship that he can just hop in and fly across the galaxy?
That's interesting. I mean, there's that scene, the sequence with the Imperials, and he says something like, they don't have a navy, which the fact that they're calling it, that suddenly they use the word navy, which I don't think was part of the lingo in Star Wars before, but let's just make it the real world. He's like, they don't have a navy. And then the guy's like, it's not a navy, sir. It's just people. You're right, by which he means property owners, which is the very definition of people. So my question for what you were saying is, where does Luke's desire to dismantle the theocracy come into this?
Like, oh, in terms of like the rebellion? Yeah. Well, yeah, no, I think that's interesting. Like, I don't know. That's where it gets interesting. It's like, it has become like, yeah, like when you look at like, what is the rebellion's, at a certain point, I mean, there's no sectarian grievance initially in Star Wars, but however, then the notion of the Jedi as a religion and the rebellion having reverence for them starts to color Star Wars as increasingly as a sectarian conflict between a religious group who venerate a group of mystics against there's also connotations that the Empire is perhaps human supremacist, although I think a lot of that's retconned in after the fact. So there's this issue. Is it a sectarian conflict? Is that? And, you know, and so I think like part of it is, again, if you want to talk about like moving the Rebel Alliance into more of a politically robust place. Yeah. Part of it was dissolving its sectarian coordinates and moving it more into a populist struggle.
I think that, I mean, we don't need to debate whether or not cultural products have larger societal implications at the moment of their release or your podcast releases. But I also think that it is very convenient that this movie comes out and Rey turns out to be nobility, just as the royal family is dealing with the pedophilia issue.
Yeah, yeah.
Like I came out of the movie and I was like, this is a very good movie for the British royals.
You?
Well, yeah. And so, like, you had asked about where does, like, Luke's desire from the previous movie you know, dismantle the theocracy. And you know, they address that head on when Luke says, I was wrong. I was just angry.
Yeah.
Oh, that explains it.
You're like, oh, yeah, exactly. Okay. So, like, he had his angsty teen years when he just wanted to go to Tashi Station. And then later he's got, like, his I don't know, crotchety old man years, like.
Yeah, I think that first off, whoever is in charge of this, J.J. Abrams, whoever wrote the film, was first off incorrect about what The Last Jedi does, because he comes to that realization in the film and says to Kylo Ren that he will not be the last Jedi, and we are given a shot of the books, the sacred Jedi texts that Rey saved.
Yeah.
So clearly that was how it was always set up. But I think that what is actually challenging and really kind of nuanced about it is that there was all of this anger that Luke wanted to get rid of the Jedi when it seems like his ultimate realization is a theological schism, really, is what it is. It's like the whole scene where he's like gets her to feel the Force. And then he's like, the Force, you know, doesn't belong to the Jedi. It doesn't belong to me. And obviously he engages in this crazy act that has the appearance of a violent act, which is he associates with the Jedi, even to the point where he like shows up and he has brown hair again and his long lost blue lightsaber. But that's an illusion. And it was actually an act of kind of selfless preservation of the rebels, really. There was no kind of violence inherent in it. And so for me, I felt like it was more significant that whole narrative completes what the prequels were doing in establishing the hypocrisy of the Jedi, and then tying in with the possibility that anybody can be force sensitive.
Against midichlorians.
I don't often buy into the kind of rugged individualism, Americanist, pull yourself up by your bootstraps bullshit. But for Star Wars, it's a far more positive message, I think, that that any individual, no matter their caste, is able to connect with the Force, mm-hmm. and achieve something through that. And it seems to me that is the importance of Luke undoing the Jedi, but still clearly. Still clearly preserving some semblance of a religious order. And that's all in that movie. And clearly when they're making the new one, they didn't get that at all. Cause they're like, we got to get a scene in there. Where Luke's
it's
like,
not just iconoclasty. It's reformism.
Yeah.
It's a reformation.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. He's Luther. Not to give me an example.
Not Dawkins.
Yeah. He's Luther, not Dawkins. Yeah. Good.
Yeah. We think we got there. Yeah,
definitely. It's definitely not Dawkins.
Yeah, and so it's super, super disappointing to then say, oh, well, Rey is a Palpatine. She actually only has power this entire time because of who she secretly was.
Yeah, because of her lineage.
Right. So which then I'm wondering, like, did Luke spend some time on Cantobite?
Did Luke spend some time on Cantobite?
Yeah, sowing his wild oats.
Because how else did his genes get there?
Because, like, Broom Boy has to be somebody's child, right?
Okay, I got you. Sorry. Right, yeah.
So, like, right, Broom Boy is the long-lost Skywalker.
Yeah. I mean, I guess you could make an argument about colonization, right? Because when you've got an earlier period, the Old Republic, where you've got thousands and thousands of Jedi that are riding out and colonizing worlds and making love with indigenous peoples,
yeah,
are then sowing the seed for a wealth of force sensitive, but that's giving a lot of credit. I don't think that's
it's pretty icky.
Well, yeah, I think in this sense of, like, in terms of stripping Star Wars of its proletarian connotations is really then to loop back to part of why Rose had to go, because Rose is a completely proletarian like resistance fighter.
Absolutely.
She's an ordinary person who took up arms in the mutual defense of her home and community. And therefore has no place.
And she's not special
in the time of heroes. Yeah, like in the times of heroes and nobility.
And I really liked how seriously they took that, because when they first introduce her and she shocks Finn, he's saying, I got to tell my friend or whatever what's happening, and she says that the Empire's onto us, and she says, well, we can just go to hyperspace, and he says, no, we can't, and explains the situation like she's a grunt who isn't even. She's not aware of whatever the larger, latest political machinations are.
Right, right. Yeah, that she wouldn't even know.
Yeah, like they took that concept of her being a no one seriously, which is set up. I mean, it's, I don't know.
I think class really sets us up good to talk about production, because there is some stuff. Star Wars is full of questions about how does anything get done?
It's one of the things that bothers me, and that I think about a lot in the Star Wars universe, is just the manufacturing. Because we don't see a lot of, like, planets that are devoted to manufacturing. We don't visit shipyards. We don't, like, there's merchant vessels.
Right. They're discussed occasionally.
Yeah. Only,
yeah, and they
only
talk
on
about
Corellia.
The shipyards. They're we like, oh, yeah, Corellia.
One time. Yeah.
But that's sort of.
And that's dystopic.
But when you see manufacturing happen, it's always the Empire that has the manufacturing capacity. And it's sort of, and I don't know exactly what the lesson here is, but it feels like it's like the evil, fascists have the ability to marshal these resources the way that they want. They can demand out of, chaos that order appear in the form of spaceships. And that's why they're able to build the Death Star so relatively quickly. Like, not the first Death Star, because that took a long, long time. But the second Death Star went...
Yeah. The mold was already there.
I guess. Yeah.
Just
you just had to pour the molten steel.
No, the second Death Star is bigger, is the thing. Durasteel, first. Mega engineering project seems to be no obstacle to the Empire.
Well, yeah, and then you've got, like, the First Order comes up with this entire planet-sized planet buster.
Even dumber and bigger.
And they can build that in secret without the New Republic knowing. And then in between episode 7 and 8, they build even bigger Star Destroyers, like the Mega Star Destroyers, and they come up with a fleet of those. And you're like, how much time has passed that you were able to build and man these enormous vessels? And they just did it. And then you've got the Final Order under Palpatine,
who,
you know, out in the middle of nowhere where no one's supposed to be able to go and no one has a path to, is able to build an entire fleet of Star Destroyers.
With Death Star technology.
Yeah, with Death Star technology on all of them.
Kevin J. Anderson, you've got your fingerprints all over this one.
Death Stars.
This is the Sun Crusher all over again.
Rip Chewie.
He
did kill Chewie, didn't he?
I believe he did.
Yeah, holy fuck.
So how do you feel about...
But the Rebellion can't put these things together. Like you see them like scrambling for whatever ships they can get. They've always got like this like hodgepodge of A-wings and X-wings and Y-wings, and not like a singular ship that is their fleet. It's just sort of like, oh well, we got some like hospital ships from Admiral Akbar, and we've got like, you know, whoever
Cal cruisers.
Yeah, like whoever just like brings their ships in, so they sort of get it, but they don't have like a concerted manufacturing capacity. So I'm like, is it that like manufacturing is an icky, gross thing, so it belongs to the evil people, or is it that fascists are just able to do this? Is it sort of the other side that like, oh well, it's, you know, the inefficiency of this bureaucratic republic, they just can't get stuff done. I don't know, but
I think we can all agree mobilization of the economy by the state is the inherent core quality of authoritarianism, Marshall DeDoy.
Right.
It's interesting that before, like in the final stages of the Republic, that they had contractors building their army and machinery, Camino, and then it's all they seize the means of production, if you will, and it's all in-house from then on with the Empire. But I think that, so you make a really good point, because again, thinking about Canto Bite and all that stuff about arms dealers, there's the scene with Benicio, who is a delight, I have to say, since this is just a
he was delightful.
Last Jedi is awesome podcast. Oh, stuttering was, that was a bold choice, and boy does it pay off. He's giving that talk to Finn, you know, where he's like, if you want to like live free, don't join. And he's going through the holo cards or whatever. And the person who owned the ship sells things to the good guys and the bad guys and shows an X-wing. And I was like, do you purchase X-wings? Like the rebels are constantly, like you said, trying to scrape together ships. I don't think they go to the X-wing dealership.
No, I never had that feeling.
And if they did, then that would make it makes the rest of the film, where it's literally this slow moving chase sequence where all of their ships are being destroyed because they're running out of gas.
Running out of space gas. You're going to hit with
artillery. It becomes fairly, like, it cheapens it at that point.
Yeah.
Because they need to do is just get to the dealership.
They have to be able to build more. I don't know. I think this is like, yeah, I think if you're going to like, yeah, you should.
Or they could put in like a hyperspace call. Like, hey, yeah, can we get an order of new X-Wings?
Yeah, exactly.
Deliver them
and
here,
send
please.
Along a medical class ship.
I mean, I see the X-Wing as being part of like, kind of like in the line of like Warsaw Pact weaponry nowadays. Like it's like in general, like they were very common patterns in military deployments historically. And then the civilization that used them was defeated by, you know, proprietary imperial tech. But, you know, there's a lot of people still using and making the older weapons. You know, just because like it's an older style of weapon, somehow better. Right. This is the one thing I never got. But anyway,
did
like,
X-wings make an appearance in the prequels? I can't remember.
No, they don't.
No, I don't.
So then,
which
one was when were the X-wings defeated?
In expanded universe lore, they are in the Old Republic. Yeah, but that's like, anyway, you know, like this is the whole thing. Anyway,
expanded,
but I just think like
universe.
you got to think about these. I think there's room to think about these things as like they are left over, but you can also make new ones of stuff. You know, like it's not, I don't know, like, yeah, like they have to be producing somewhere. But part of this, I think, is like, also, we talk about like you and we were talking earlier, Justin talked about like how the rebels, the Empire is close to machinery, but the rebels are close to nature.
Right. Which I don't think, I mean, that doesn't say anything about what Marshall is saying about who has control of manufacturing. I don't know what it is in the narrative, and I'm hard pressed to wonder if it's in the previous trilogies. But it's the competing interests, but I don't know if it says anything necessarily about the Empire's ability to manifest all of these ships. I like it. I thought the snake healing scene, as contrived as it may have been, I appreciated that development, and I liked the crystal wolves.
The snake healing scene?
Yeah. Ray heals the snake.
Oh, yeah.
Snake healing scene, yeah, which is like, it's like a Dungeons & Dragons, literally, they're like, and now you confront the giant snake.
Do you fight it?
Healing power.
What's your next move?
On the manufacturing line, what's going on with the final order? And just quickly, let me say, cause I got to get this out. I got to get this on record. I really disliked all the Palpatine stuff
so much.
Ian McDiarmid is the best. and so this goes back to what we were first talking about like it's trash, but you love it. That whole first sequence with him, and there's like the chiaroscuro, like pulsating shot of his face, and then he's just like going for it 110%. And I've always felt like he's the MVP of the prequels. He's incredible. And so while the whole time I was like, this is phenomenally stupid that they brought him back, it's also just delightful to see him as Palpatine, no matter what's going on.
Yeah, I know he does an incredible job as Palpatine. Absolutely, it aggravated me to no end.
Just the giant robo arm that is assumedly attached to the roof, but is actually out of shot, so they don't have to show you how that's moving around. that comes down to the point of just like his limp body with you. I was just like, this is. I don't think they intend this to be as funny as it is.
Right. It's supposed to be menacing, and you're sort of like, okay.
I mean, it's literally a marionette.
Even though I hate it, I still love it because he's like, Ian McDiarmid has more than anyone else, I think, understands the style of acting that belongs in Star Wars, like the certain kind of hammy stiltedness that he just delivers better than anybody else. I want to say that, but so what are they, has he manifested the fleet through the Force? Were his secret loyal, faceless cultists building them?
Yeah. Like
I'm not going to answer.
I don't know that I have an answer, but I also don't know that it necessarily requires an answer.
No.
Because either way, whether he was secretly building them somewhere, which if he was secretly building them, just speaks to the like the how ineffective then the New Republic was, and just how good evil is at doing this stuff. So it's sort of like, yeah, manufacturing stuff is icky, so that's what the Emperor does. You know, we the good people just, you know, scrounge it up from whoever has it. The evil people manufacture their stuff. But and if he's just been able to sort of like manifest it through the Force, then you would think that, you know, somebody on the Jedi's side would be able to do something similar, unless they've decided that, you know, manifesting vessels is a Sith power. No. You can't manifest vessels until you've done at least like a level 7 evil thing.
Yeah. I mean, they don't know what the hell they're doing, because they earlier in the film, when Rey lightning bolts the transport that Chewie's apparently on, it immediately blows up And then at the end of the film, when the Emperor does it to all the ships, they just power down.
Yeah.
And are kind of adrift for a while. I'm like, why aren't...
They should all just be blowing
up. Blow them up?
Right?
Anyway, but that is, I mean, debating that stuff is just inane. And as you said, it doesn't matter. You talking about this, I find it interesting that I don't think it was the original intention when Lucas made the first one, but that every subsequent film became about destroying whatever their latest technological wonder is through fatal and, in my opinion, unintentional flaws in the manufacturing.
Right. Yes.
I mean, they obviously Rogue One, the whole point of Rogue One exists to explain that weakness was built in. But whenever, like when I was a kid watching that movie, I always assumed it was like someone, like an engine, a rebel engineer got a hold of the plans and was like, oh shit, this exhaust port is exposed.
Yeah. And it's the only one.
Yeah. And then everyone subsequently, it's like that doesn't even have to, they've already done that narrative beat. So now they don't even have to really go out of their way to explain how the ragtag group is going to find manufacturing flaws. Because I guess the second Death Star, they just fly straight in there. It's not done.
Yeah.
But then like I can't but even it's like quite Starkiller operational. Base. I'm trying to think now. Well, no, Starkiller Base is, I guess that's important because Finn was the janitor.
Yeah, he was the janitor, so he knew about it. And they also blew a hole open inside of it to actually like give them access.
Right.
I don't know. And I mean, maybe it's nothing, but even just seeing the manufacturing happen in this universe is you only ever see the end results of it. You never see it.
Yeah, and whenever you do, it's always bad and dirty.
Yes.
And I for me, that always connects with my criticism of Deep Ecology. Right. And I'm like, you know, it's the pastoral is good. And so things that drag us deeper into production, things that drag us deeper into geological extraction or other things are inherently bad. And then it takes the work and then it makes kind of everything that is inherently working class and productive base and wrong. And thus tries to put the entire progressive agenda against working people and forever forestalls the question of seizing the means of production, which right. makes Deep Ecology a very dangerous idea to the progressive movement and any attempts to actually change the system. As much as it has a lot of, you know, things within it that, you know, seem very important. I'm really on the fence about Deep Ecology because, you know, I see the value and I see the importance of it, and there's some, but I also see it's how it's continuously used as a bludgeon against, you know, leftism in the ecological movement.
Yeah, I mean, I would say that I mean, we could have a whole other side conversation about that, but in terms of Star Wars, again, this the kind of the ecological elements of the most recent trilogy is a new thing. I mean, Star Wars isn't really doing that, just given that the rebels that we're familiar with are all working class gearheads, basically,
mm-hmm.
right? And they're kind of maintaining machinery from bygone eras. Part of it may be out of necessity, but it's also clearly a love. You know, like I think that you saying that is really interesting. Then to think about all of the sequences in all of the films of like people running around fixing the Falcon, you know, or like there's like oil is shooting out and that's the thing is just constantly falling apart. And yet they're holding it together through labor. And I appreciate it. That's one thing I appreciate about Rise of Skywalker is that there are actually a few instances where they're using it as an excuse to get more narrative beats in because they got to cram in as many as they can. But like, it's like as soon as they get on the ship, individuals split up and get their tools out and are fixing things.
Right.
I don't think the ecological stuff is, it didn't turn out to be that robust, though I do take the larger point you're making.
Well, I just have an axe to grind personally. So I just like to bring it out whenever I can.
Yeah, no. And I agree with you in the sense that, in my opinion, any kind of ecological renewal, let's say in industry, starts with working people, and it starts with an investment in folks and education, retraining, and whatever it might be, in a way that will not happen so long as, just what you were saying, that the left is stigmatizing the working class, and then the right weaponizes false consciousness.
Yeah.
To make the working class think precisely that the left is so antagonistic towards them that they actually have more in common with billionaires.
It's a sad state. We've covered, I think, quite a bit here, but is there anything else that you wanted to get off your chest about The Rise of Skywalker?
The so-called fandom menace, which is all of the racists that hate the Last Jedi.
It's a clever name.
But there's also there's a war going on right now between Reylos, so folks who ship Rey and Kylo, who are very upset, even though they got what they wanted, because Ben obviously dies right away. You, there's no possibility of an additional romance film with Rey and Ben, which I don't discount anyone's fandom. You know, like, everyone's got their thing, and God bless them. But there's a fight between them and other folks that were like potentially shipping Poe and Finn, or Rey and Finn. And there's, in the Reylo community, there's a real streak of like just really vile racism. You know, like Rey has to be with, cannot be with Finn because he's a person of color.
Right.
And that's the way I would put it, not the way that they put it.
Yes.
So it's, it's some ugly shit, but I think that it's like, it also speaks to how petrified Disney and everyone made this film was. You know, like I'm sympathetic to Finn and Poe. And I think that especially if you watch that first film, they set up that kind of chemistry between the two of them.
Oh yeah.
I really thought that's how that was going.
But when it comes down to it, they can't, they're shitting themselves. And so they put in this one shot of a same-sex couple kissing each other at the end that they cut in foreign markets.
Yeah, yeah.
And they know they can't cut a whole storyline, and so they invent narratives. They invented this Carrie Russell character, and made the only Latino character a drug dealer.
Yeah, yeah. That was a really poor choice.
And then also they're like, we already had another love interest for Finn, but even that's too problematic. So
we had to take Rose out of it.
Yeah. So it's really ugly stuff. And just like the lack of confidence in doing anything. Like, I think that any of these things we're talking about would not make the film, in my opinion, by any stretch of the imagination, a kind of like social justice warrior wet dream.
No,
it would just reflect the real world,
which I guess is a social justice warrior wet dream.
Yeah, well, there you go. Exactly. And it kind of pisses me off because it's like, say what you will about the prequels, like that George Lucas was uncompromising and confident in what he was doing. And it's problematic and it's difficult to watch, but it's like he did not back down. And these films felt like they were made by a committee.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah, absolutely they did.
So I guess I'm saying it's better for a film to be made by one white guy instead of a committee of old white guys, which counteracts what I said.
But authorial intent is also completely bunk, so.
Yeah.
Well, there you go. So we end much as we began.
Why don't we all, in summation, say something we liked about Rise of Skywalker?
I mean, this is trite, but I really liked C-3PO, like his whole arc.
Yes, I was very finally. I found it very frustrating that we still don't get any R2, but I find it very frustrating that they are the main characters of the other two trilogy, and then we basically don't get them at all.
Yeah, yeah.
In this trilogy, so yes, I enjoyed the 3PO stuff a lot.
And then it also gave us Babu Fink. So
okay, so you say what you like, Steven, because I'm still thinking about it.
I remembered what I liked about this. And I really think that the whole dyad dynamic between like Kylo Ren and Rey is like, I think is actually one of the most, that's the interesting dynamic. And then also kind of like the spiritualism of it, like when she heals him, like, you know, mm-hmm. I thought that was like, that was very cool. And I think that's one of the more, and like the way they play with like trying to figure out where each other are, like, and the mind games of that. And when she spills the jar or whatever, you know, and then it shows up.
Yeah. And then Kylo like can see helmet. It.
And like, yeah, those, all those kind of games, you know, that they play with each other, and that dynamic, I thought, well, that was really fun and really very interesting. And that was something I really enjoyed about the movie.
The thing that I like, I would say I like the same thing, Steve, in that Star Wars for me, what my favorite stuff is always the religious mythology.
Yeah.
So it was like, and like, as stupid as the story was, like, again, the child in me, all of the stuff with like this secret Sith planet, and there's like faceless, insane cultists. And there's like the Ralph McQuarrie Sith throne. And there's like a Liam Neeson voiceover briefly. And yeah, healing and like her handing off the lights.
Her handing off the lightsaber was actually legitimately brilliant.
Yeah. And one of the few payoffs from the previous film.
Yes.
Yeah. So I really liked all of that. I will say the trivial thing that I really liked, were Palpatine's hands.
Okay.
Because obviously, as we know, Palpatine is horrifically scarred by Mace Windu at the end of Revenge of the Sith. And then he's just like a grizzled husk from then on. And then he gets tossed down a shaft by Darth Vader. The Death Star explodes. His body is assumedly hurled with the wreckage to yet another moon of Endor, something else that pissed me off, because I'm like, you can't go to the same moon of Endor. Like, I know they showed Ewoks briefly, but like, you can go to the forest planet without like spending a bunch of time with Ewoks anyway. Hurled into the atmosphere of this place, blah blah blah. Somehow his corpse survives, and he wills himself to be living through the dark side or whatever it was. But then when you see him, he's not, his face is not any more grizzled than it was before. Except that he holds up his hands dramatically and he has like nub fingers. And that's it. And then later when he sucks the life force out of whatever the hell that was, out of Ben and Ray, they literally have a shot of his fingers regrowing.
Oh, right.
I have it, both Amber and I, struggle with extreme dry skin issues on our hands in the winter, to the degree that like my hand is like cracked and bleeding. And so now it's a running gag around here that we have Palpatine hands.
Okay. That's incredible.
So that's what I liked. Palpatine's hands.
Well, this has been excellent. We always appreciate when you're on the show, Justin. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
And thank you, everyone who's still with us.
Stuck it out.
Made it to the end. We're eager to hear anything that you have to say to us. You can find us on Twitter. The show is at Asset Droid. You can find me, Marshall, at EconoBoyd.
And you can find me at SteveSteve at androidsandassets.ca. It's my email, which I know we weren't doing emails, but we're doing it now. And at Twitter, you can find me at SteveDroids, plural.
And you can find me at home thinking that Twitter is a vile cesspool.
If you have opinions that you want to share with us that you don't feel like sharing on the public vile cesspool of Twitter, you can email me, Marshall, at androidsandassets.ca. That's MARSHALL at androidsandassets.ca.
And I am Steve, STEVE, at androidsandassets.ca.
And I also don't have an email. I'm at the end of a tin can and some string.
That's right. Something that's super helpful for us is if you can rate and review us on things like Apple Podcast or on Stitcher. That brings us up in the rankings makes us more viewable to more people, because you know, it's important that people have the opportunity to listen to a group of white guys tell them what they think about pop culture.
At last.
You'll only get it here.
Oh God,
again, thanks so much for listening. Encourage your friends to subscribe the next time you're at a communist knitting circle. Turn us on and let everyone know just how glorious we actually are. Thanks for listening. Bye.